From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are deadlocked in the new ABC Washington Post poll out today. Their first, conducted entirely after FBI Director James Comey made public that he's investigating newly discovered Clinton-related emails. Democrats and some Republicans are crying foul about that announcement so close to the election. Then yesterday, the FBI also released a trove of documents about Bill Clinton's pardon of fugitive financier and Clinton donor Mark Rich almost 16 years ago. Here's Hillary Clinton yesterday in Florida.
Don't get distracted. Don't get diverted. Focus on the kind of country and world that we want to help create.
But will these releases affect the early voting or voting that's already happened? In a handful of states, you can change your early vote. And Donald Trump, campaigning in one of them, Wisconsin, urged people to do just that.
So if you live here, or in Michigan, or Pennsylvania, or Minnesota, those four places, you can change your vote to Donald Trump. We'll make America great again, okay?
Well, and in New Hampshire and some other states, you can change your absentee ballots. Rebecca Sinderbrand is Deputy National Political Editor at The Washington Post and Managing Editor of The Fix. And Rebecca, start there. Many Americans are waking up and saying, what, you can do this? Apparently, a handful of people called into New Hampshire officials and asked to change their absentee ballots. They were told it's unprecedented in a presidential election, but you can by voting in the first 2 hours on Tuesday. So there's these different rules that people are finding out about. Do you get the sense, though, that these FBI disclosures are making people want to change their early voting?
Well, we have to be clear. Well, first of all, yes, people can technically change their vote. Are they likely to? No, not in huge numbers. And it's more about the narrative, about getting the idea out there that people might want to switch their preference. It's really aimed at people who haven't cast their votes yet, this idea that someone would do something like this. The question now is it affecting people's votes? Not necessarily in the sense of people switching their support between candidates. The question is what it does to enthusiasm, whether it gives Republican enthusiasm a boost and perhaps depresses Democratic turnout. That's where you could see it start to shift votes or shift results a bit. It's not necessarily, and you're not going to see huge numbers of people in this environment switching their vote from one candidate to another.
Well, and yet we've seen the landscape change since the disclosures on Friday, hasn't it? I mean, the tightened race.
That's right. And again, that's a function and effect of what we're seeing in terms of Republicans coming home, a slightly increased level of Republican enthusiasm and some depressed turnout, some commensurate drop in enthusiasm among Democratic voters. Now, whether this is something that's sustained, something that we're going to keep seeing, it's hard to say. You know, there's not a lot of time for the dynamic to change, but we should note that as long as we're talking about early voting, Hillary Clinton has a massive advantage in many areas, has banked quite a few votes at this point in a way that Donald Trump just has not.
Well, by the way, we mentioned the FBI release of the documents having to do with Bill Clinton's pardon of one of his supporters 16 years ago in his last day in office. The FBI, we should say, says they were made public because of multiple Freedom of Information Act requests that trigger these automatically. Of course, Democrats are crying foul at that. But you're talking about voter depression and suppression. Later this afternoon, President Obama will be campaigning for Hillary Clinton in North Carolina, where early voting there has been shortened. There's less time. And African-American turnout is down. Democrats think that's connected. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's certainly what you're hearing from a lot of people. You cannot argue with the fact that there is a drastically decreased access to early voting in North Carolina, and it's been the subject of much controversy, of course, with judges saying, look, it looks as though African-American voters were specifically targeted in terms of limiting access. And in that sense, it's become a battleground and a rallying cry for Democrats. Mm-hmm. You're hearing from Democrats. They used it in the past and are using it now to try to actually boost enthusiasm and boost turnout.
Yeah. Is it just outside of other anvils that might drop on candidates' heads with the few seconds we have here, Rebecca? Is it just get out the vote till Tuesday?
Absolutely. And it's getting out your own voters. Again, getting that African-American vote increased from Hillary Clinton's perspective and from Donald Trump's perspective, keeping those Republicans coming home and keeping that enthusiasm high.
Rebecca Sinderbrand, Deputy National Political Editor at The Washington Post, Managing Editor of The Fix. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, as the candidates ramp up spending on ads in the final days before the election, listen to this ad from the Democratic Super PAC Priorities USA.
When I saw Donald Trump mock a disabled person, I was just shocked.
You got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
That reporter he is talking about suffers from a chronic condition that impairs movement of his arms.
That is not the only ad to talk about the moment when Donald Trump mocked a disabled reporter. Now, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 53 million people have a disability in the U.S. That's one out of five adults. Joining us now via Skype from San Francisco is Alice Wong, who is the founder and project coordinator of the Disability Visibility Project and co-partner in the Crip the Vote campaign. Alice, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, what was your reaction, your first reaction to that incident with Trump mocking the disabled reporter? And is that something that still sticks in your mind?
Well, I did a really long and hard eye roll. So, you know, when I first saw that, you know, it was disappointing. I mean, it was really clearly he was mocking a disabled person who, you know, is a journalist just doing his job. And, you know, he just pretty much belittles him in an election event. In a lot of ways, I feel like a lot of non-disabled people were shocked and had a far more visceral reaction. You know, this kind of bullying and kind of casual, you know, discrimination happens to a lot of us. So,
well, how often does that kind of thing happen? How often do people make fun of the disabled and you see it happen in your own life?
Well, I think a lot of it is much more subtle now. It's much more about microaggressions, which are, you know, just as insidious and just as damaging, you know. For example, when I'm out by myself at a cafe, people will still come up to me because I'm a wheelchair user. They're like, "Are you by yourself?" I'm like, "Yes, I am." So there's still a lot of paternalism and a lot of fatalization. And I think this is another, you know, thing we've seen in the media with the elections, that, you know, people with disabilities are seen as this kind of vulnerable, you know, oh, we can't bully them. We, you know, we got to protect them. And I feel like there's also another aspect that, you know, people with disabilities can speak for themselves, can defend themselves. We just need to kind of listen to them.
So you created the Disability Visibility Project. What is that?
It first started out as a community partnership with StoryCorps, and it collects oral histories from people with disabilities. I started it in 2014 as a lead up to the celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And now it's really grown into this full-fledged online community now.
And what about Crip the Vote? What is that?
Crip the Vote is a nonpartisan online campaign to engage both voters and politicians in a productive discussion about disability issues in the United States.
And are there issues for the disabled on the ballot this year, in your view? Do you think that whoever is president is going to make a difference for you?
Well, I think one thing we've seen in the second and third debates was a discussion about the Affordable Care Act. For people with disabilities, Obamacare has literally saved many, many lives. You know, this whole idea about people with pre-existing conditions can no longer be discriminated against. This was a huge thing about the ACA that most people kind of forget, that this is also a disability rights act for a lot of people.
You know, a lot of people around this country have already voted, and many of them have had to wait for an hour, 2 hours in line in order to cast their ballots. Are there challenges for the disabled when they go to vote that are different that we should be thinking about as Election Day nears?
Yeah, we can look at it two ways. That a lot of coverage we see about voter suppression and voter ID, they disproportionately impact older adults and people with disabilities who may not have the ability to get a ID or may not be able to wait in line for hours and hours. So when there are states and communities with fewer polling places, it really will impact people with disabilities who may not be able to wait a long line in the heat, may not have the energy, may live in communities that have really poor public transportation, and it may take them in an hour or two to get to the accessible polling place. And there's still a lot of polling places where they're not accessible physically. So it's really still a problem.
That's Alice Wong, the founder and project coordinator of the Disability Visibility Project and co-partner in the Crypt the Vote campaign. We'll link you to those at hereandnow.org. Alice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our next guest was the first Secretary of Defense to come from the ranks of enlisted combat veterans. He fought in Vietnam. He led the Defense Department under President Obama from 2013 to 2015 and resigned in what he called a mutual decision between him and President Obama. Before he became Secretary of Defense, he was a two-term Republican senator from Nebraska who voted for the Iraq War, but later broke with the Bush administration over how it was being conducted. Chuck Hagel is now a visiting fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, and he joins us now. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So are you ready to support any candidate for president this year?
Well, I, like most Americans, have been much aware of this campaign and listening carefully. And I will vote. I haven't decided yet how I will vote, but I have not missed a federal election vote every 2 years since 1968, when I first voted on top of a tank in Vietnam. So I'm very proud of that record.
But people may be surprised to hear that the former Secretary of Defense, a former U.S. senator, is right now an undecided voter.
Well, I'm not sure that's unusual. Just because I've been in politics and in the cabinet, it doesn't mean that I don't carefully listen and analyze and assess things, because I do. I have never been just an automatic vote for the Republican Party or any other party, and that's gotten me in trouble over the years with my own party. But I think a citizen has a responsibility to make the best judgment he or she can based on what he or she thinks is the right thing for the country. I did that in the Senate. I've done that in my entire career. So I don't think that's any different from casting a vote. At least that's the way I look at it.
Could you see yourself supporting Donald Trump?
Well, like I've said, I haven't decided who I'm going to vote for, so
it could
we'll
be
see.
Either Trump, Clinton, or one of the others?
Well, it could be a whole list of things. John Kasich voted for John McCain, so.
Right. Well, what do you think about what's happening in the Republican Party right now? This is the party that you were a part of for a mm-hmm. long time.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not sure what the Republican Party is or what it stands for or what the governing philosophy of the Republican Party is. It's not the Republican Party I started out in many, many years ago. I think it's today an amalgamation of tribes. And the Republican Party is going to have to come to some new center of gravity in what it is and what it believes, at least their governing philosophy. You have today different groups within the party, dominated one group by the social issue conservatives, another by the financial issues Republicans, another by the so-called hawkish Republicans who want to use the military everywhere and more. You've got another group that's a small government, less taxes crowd. So it's an amalgamation of different groups with no clear leader in the party itself. Parties are and have to be bigger than that. They have to be, as you've heard the old saying, it's got to be a wider tent. And also it's a party that I think has alienated minorities, and I think has politically done a lot of dumb things. And I'm still a Republican, and I'm not going to walk away from the Republican Party, but the Republican Party needs to get itself put back together and be relevant again. And when you look at, for example, registered voters in America today, not the majority, but the plurality, I believe, are independents. And the Republicans are third in that voter registration nationally. Well, a national party can't continue to survive that way. So I think the Republican Party will find that new center of gravity, or there will be something to replace it.
What about on the Democratic side? What's holding you back from supporting Hillary Clinton?
Well, I'm not going to get into the specifics of Trump or Clinton, but as I said, I've watched and I know them both. I worked with Hillary Clinton know, of course, of her experience and have a relationship with her. And so I'm not going to debate the merits of either one right now.
What do you think the next president is going to have to do to deal with the divisiveness in this country right now? We've heard all about the anxiety that this election is causing so many people.
Well, I think that's the most immediate and biggest challenge that the next president is going to have as to how do you bring this country back together to responsibly govern. How do you lead a government that is functioning and it's functional? That's going to be difficult because of the bitterness and the hatred and the vitriol that has been spewed out of both campaigns all year long. And you don't just fix that on November 9th or January 20th. This is going to be a tall order. And this is at a time when I think America and certainly the next president is going to be faced with an agenda of immensely complicated and combustible and interconnected problems, not just in the United States, but in the world. So this is going to be a tall order, but the next president is going to have to do that. And I think that's got to be a first priority for this next president, reaching out to the Congress, reaching out to both parties, reaching out to our allies around the world, and I think reaching out to President Putin and others.
You were Secretary of Defense when the fight against ISIS really got started. As you know, right now, U.S. troops are helping Iraqi forces and Kurdish forces try to retake the biggest city that ISIS controls, Mosul, in Iraq. How do you see the fight against ISIS going? And do you think that it will be significant in that fight if the U.S. as well as Iraqi forces are able to retake Mosul?
Well, first of all, that accumulation of forces will take Mosul because they will so overpower ISIS. And I mean, you've got Turkish troops are going to be involved, different Kurdish troops, as you said. You've got Shia militia involved, Iraqi regular forces. We're involved, the United States. Some of our NATO allies have been flying sorties with us on this, the GCC countries. Many, many forces, actually, which complicates it. The real issue is not whether Mosul can be retaken. It will be retaken. It's what happens afterward.
Right.
And that's the whole set of questions we did not ask ourselves before we invaded Iraq in 2003. Who governs? Who's legitimate to govern? How will the new governing coalitions be established? How are you going to rebuild the country? How are you going to put together historic religious, ethnic tribal differences between Kurds, Shias, Sunnis, which got them into the trouble that they're in right now and which allowed ISIS to take Mosul and when the Iraqi divisions dropped their weapons and ran. So these are the bigger issues, I think. And then it isn't just one country. We can't ask just questions about Iraq. This is a regional issue. It's Syria. It's Iraq. It's Libya. It's Yemen. Lebanon has just announced it's going to have a new president, which is different from what we've seen before, which gives the Iranians more influence in Lebanon, the Saudis less. So this is regional, and I think we've got to come at it on a regional basis.
One more question, Secretary Hagel. One of the things that many people, even people who are with President Obama on a lot of other issues, have criticized him for is that he set a red line in Syria about chemical weapons and then didn't follow through on it. You've been one that has criticized him as well on that. What do you think he should have done there?
Well, I think once he laid that out, and by the way, that statement by the president was made before I got there, but after it was confirmed by the United Nations and other independent groups, and in fact, Assad's troops had used chemical weapons more than once against the civilians, and the president of the United States had told the world that that was a red line and Assad would suffer consequences, then action had to be taken. And there were many options as to what we could have done and what, in fact, we had agreed to do and were going to do until it was pulled down. I think that decision to pull it down after it was agreed to go ahead with it cost the country and the Obama administration a great credibility and trust in our leaders around the world and our allies. And I heard it from everybody. I heard it from our NATO allies. I heard it from our GCC partners that we can no longer trust the word of the United States. It's complicated. I get that. No easy answers. I get that. But what it tells us is, and it's a lesson for any president, when a president makes a statement like that to the world and he raises the hope of people in those areas. And you got to remember, it isn't just our allies and the people in that area listening carefully. Our adversaries are listening carefully as well. But when you make a statement like that, you better do something to follow through on that, because it will affect your credibility and your trust. And that is the coin of the realm in everything, in all relationships, and certainly in foreign policy.
That's Chuck Hagel, former U.S. Secretary of Defense, a Republican senator from Nebraska. He's now a visiting fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics. Secretary Hagel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now, maybe some unwelcome news for many. So-called good cholesterol may not be so good. It's long been thought to scrub blood vessels of the bad clogging cholesterol, but a new study out this week in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology finds that boosting good cholesterol, or HDL, isn't actually that effective at protecting against heart disease and stroke. Damien Gardet covers biotech for STAT, the health and medicine publication and our weekly partner. And Damien, you paint a great picture of HDL as just a fatty substance along for the ride. So what did the study find?
Yeah, so basically these researchers in Canada looked at a data set from more than 600,000 people, which is the most anyone's ever really amassed to study this, and sorted them by HDL rates, basically from low to high. And what they found is those who had basement-level HDL did have an increased risk of cardiovascular death. But once they got to a certain level, that risk plateaued. And so this kind of stands in contrast to what had been conventional wisdom, that continuing to raise HDL would just improve patient outcomes, when in reality it would seem that there's a cap on that.
Well, in fact, a very, very high HDL didn't seem protective at all.
Exactly. So risks actually ticked upward once you got into the very, very top eighth, which was a smaller number of patients, but still enough to be confounding.
Well, and just to stay with the basement level of HDL, having a higher incident of death and other problems, that would seem to lend to the thinking that you should, as we've been told, eat beans and lentils and oats and oily fish to raise the good HDL. I mean, it does seem that to raise it to that plateau might seem like a good idea, no?
Very much so. However, what's further confounding is that those basement-level HDL patients also had higher rates of obesity and smoking and poorer diets and lower socioeconomic status. And each of those factors is itself correlated with risk. So what question gets raised is sort of, is HDL really an independent indicator of risk, or is it just something that is perhaps correlated with these other factors? And right. So it's true that improving diet, quitting smoking, and et cetera, would seem to raise your HDL and get you to that healthy level. But it's very possible that there's some other correlation there, and HDL itself is not the factor right. that is improving these outcomes.
Well, what does this do to the drug industry, which has drugs out there that are supposed to raise your HDL and lower the LDL, the bad cholesterol? Where are we on the drugs component here?
So for many people in the drug industry, this might sound eerily familiar, because they have spent billions of dollars over the past decade trying to develop drugs that would do exactly that. They would raise HDL in order to ward off heart attacks and strokes and other dangerous things. And by one measure, did they succeed in that these drugs did, in clinical trials, raise good cholesterol. But by the most important measure, they failed in that each of these drugs has failed to actually improve outcomes. So that would kind of lend credence to the hypothesis put forth by this paper, which is that simply boosting HDL into astronomical levels doesn't really have an effect on patient health.
But is the takeaway that your HDL, at the very least, could tell you about other problems?
Right. And so I think that's why doctors are cautious to not, you know, that there might be a baby in this bathwater in a sense, which is that if HDL is not an independent indicator but is correlated with things like obesity and smoking, then testing for it could still have some value because asking patients to fill out a questionnaire about their exercise habits and et cetera can be a little bit more cumbersome than simply doing a lipid panel that you would do anyway to search for bad cholesterol. So HDL is here to stay. I think it's just maybe not the great indicator that it once was thought to be.
Damien Gardet, who covers biotech for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Damien, thank you.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
The word theater comes from the Greek, meaning seeing plays. But there are some who believe the enjoyment of theater should not depend on your ability to see. Stina Sieg from Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports on how some theaters in Phoenix are making shows more accessible to the visually impaired.
The show hasn't started yet at Phoenix Theater, but David Strife's job has. Sitting on a platform overlooking the stage, he leans into a microphone and describes what he sees.
There's a two-story brick building, a business sign above a roll-top storefront door that reads Rosario's Car and Limo Service on the first floor there.
Strife's words are going straight into the headphones of a visually impaired theater goer sitting in the audience. When the play starts, Strife will keep going, speaking in between the dialogue, describing important actions, facial expressions, even costumes, whatever it takes to help that patron completely picture tonight's musical, In the Heights, by Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame. This process is called audio description, and for the visually impaired,
it's huge. It's absolutely huge.
Marlo Kohler knows that now, but when she first lost her sight a decade ago, she had no idea what audio description was. Then she heard a demo, not during a play, but a movie.
Ghost.
Oh, my love, my darling.
And I'm going to bet you know the scene. Demi Moore, Patrick Swayze, a pottery wheel.
And he goes behind her sensually. And the describer was so good.
Lonely time.
I would have never known what was happening in that scene.
A little while later, Kohler heard live musical theater audio described for the first time. The show was Phantom of the Opera, and longtime audio describer Sue Berliner was the one speaking into Kohler's headphones.
I cried. I said, Sue, I had no idea how much I was missing until you described the musicals for me.
That's when Kohler, a social worker, took up spreading audio description as one of her causes.
Sometimes I'm a little pain in the tush because I'm relentless.
Kohler and others persuaded most movie theaters in the Phoenix area to offer audio description. But when it comes to live theater here, there's only one group that trains audio describers, Artability AZ, and only a handful of theaters that offer audio described shows. That's pretty typical across the country. In many states, only a small percentage of theaters, usually in big cities, offer the service. In other states, no theaters offer it at all. Education might be part of the problem.
If they don't know about it, they can't do anything about it.
Tom Belshon lost his sight 40 years ago, but that doesn't stop him from going to about 25 plays a year. In a perfect world, all of those would be audio described, but he knows, right now, that's just not realistic.
There aren't enough of us that go.
Which means there isn't enough demand to make audio description universal yet. That's why Sue Berliner, who's been an audio describer for nearly 20 years, says whenever she meets a visually impaired person, she tells them about the service, which is free, by the way.
I want to be supportive, and I want to be supportive of access in every sense of the imagination.
Which also means supporting newer audio describers, like David Strife. Back at Phoenix Theater, the show is hurtling toward the end of Act One. The actors are dancing across the stage. To their left, two women are frenetically signing for deaf patrons. And up above it all, there's Strife, describing a tender moment between the musical's two romantic leads.
They look at each other, run towards each other, meet, embrace, kiss. Lights out.
The scene is sweet and exhilarating. And understood by everyone in the house. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Phoenix.
House lights up, end of Act One.
Yesterday, on his syndicated radio show, Sean Hannity mentioned a news story about a huge divide in the Democratic Party because of the FBI's continued investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. He said, "It says Michelle Obama has deleted Hillary tweets from her timeline." Then a caller responded.
What? Barack Obama?
Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren have both unfollowed Hillary Clinton as well as scrubbing their timeline of tweets about her.
Wow. That means they know it's huge. You know why? Because Obama's implicated. He's implicated here. And he's pissed. You know what his legacy might be? Jail.
Well, the only problem is none of that is true. In fact, Elizabeth Warren's most recent tweet is in support of Clinton. President Obama is in North Carolina today campaigning for her. The info was on a website called The Gateway Pundit. Hannity tweeted an apology after the show, but how much else is out there? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now. David, we've been hearing a lot about these fake news sites, but also the Facebook sites plugging them. BuzzFeed published an analysis. It's on both sides of the aisle. What'd they find?
It was really impressive. They looked over thousands of posts, looking at both sort of straight-up news sites as well as right-wing pages, left-wing pages. They found the conservative, these sort of fake news sites published either a mixture of true and false elements in their stories or outright falsities 38% of the time. And for left-wing sites, it was still an appreciable percentage, half of that, 19% of the time. And let me run down just briefly a couple of the examples that BuzzFeed found. They found that the conservative ones pushed conspiracy theory about Hillary Clinton using a body double during health concerns. They recirculated an old and false story about a Canadian mayor lecturing Muslim immigrants about integration, wrongly claimed, and I'm quoting here, that Obama's last address at the UN saw him tell Americans they needed to give up their freedom for a new world government, and falsely claimed that the NFL had told a football player he could not pray. Meanwhile, on the left, there were claims that Putin had set up an online troll factory that was responsible for rigging online polls to show that Trump had won the first debate, claimed that TV networks would not be fact-checking Donald Trump in any way. And another story said women in the military, the American armed forces, should expect to be raped. All of these essentially untrue stories, and some of them really damaging. One of them that they highlighted was from a website called Freedom Daily, and the headline was, "Two white men doused with gasoline set on fire by blacks, media censored with video." And it showed this really appalling video of these two men on fire. Mm. What they didn't say was that, you know, in the first line of the story, it said, "You can't make this stuff up," but a lot of the stuff was made up. It was not linked to Black Lives Matter a movement, although that was what was claimed on the site's webpage. It took place a year ago. It was not a current event. Both people involved were people of color. White people were not involved in this incident in any way as victims. And in fact, this wasn't covered up, but was actually covered by local and national media. So none of that was true. And also, it was in service of an incredibly divisive and I think racially harmful end, which is to stir up racial antagonism.
Well, look, I mean, when it comes to Sean Hannity, you'd think he would know that we would all know if somehow Barack Obama had scrubbed all of his tweets about Hillary Clinton, that you'd know that. But for other people, you hear some of these things. I mean, some of these sites, David, there's one that purports to be ABC News and it looks exactly like ABC News. So how do people know when a story's real?
Well, look, I mean, that kind of site, and there's some others like it, are intentionally set up to mislead people and have names that seem credible or seem to be taken on the names of some other sites. One of the things I think you have to do is to figure out what sources you trust and also to test, just use certain kinds of common sense tests. It requires more effort by us as readers, but you say, all right, are they doing their homework in public? Are they linking to original documents? Are they linking to actual interviews? Are they showing the context of the remarks that are purportedly representing, you know, particularly sharp criticism or exposés or whatever it is that's controversial, that's the meat of the story? You know, just as, you know, you can't take advertisements in political campaigns completely at face value, you want to make sure that the sources of the information you're getting are both reliable and are showing you why you can rely on them. But this takes a lot more effort of us. It's essentially what's called news literacy. Mm-hmm. It's requiring of us to think critically about our sources of information and to not simply take something at face value. In the case of Sean Hannity, he needed to the link, and his producers needed to protect him as well and do so and go to the original source of the information. And once you did that, Brian Stelter of CNN did a very nice job with this. You found that the site itself had essentially no supporting material to back up its claims.
Well, as I said, there are maybe two prongs here. People who are understandably misled by websites and people who maybe want to be misled and, you know, maybe somewhere know that, well, that can't be true. So both things going on. But, you know, reader beware. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
The Cleveland Indians and the Chicago Cubs will face off tonight in Game 7 of the 2016 World Series. The Cubs made a comeback after trailing 3-1 in the series. Here's Cubs fan Larry Overstreet, who drove from Chicago to Cleveland to watch the game.
This is historic for our club. After 108 years of a drought, this is just historic. It's just everything's going to be really crazy if they win out on it.
Joining us now via Skype is Cheryl Ray Stout, sports reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you doing, Jeremy?
Doing well, and Rick Jackson is with us as well, host at WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland, so we can have a nice, fair discussion. Hi, Rick, welcome back to you.
Hi, Jeremy. Good to hear you.
Okay, so let's start with Chicago, Cheryl, since you guys won last night. And by the way, I'll put it out there that you're straight reporters. We don't want to say that you're a fan of one team or the other. But Cheryl, what's the feeling among Cubs fans right now?
Optimistic, because they were concerned going into last night's game, and they saw their offense exploded last night, and they're encouraged about tonight.
Encouraged? That's it? That's the best you can do for Chicago today? I would think the bars are already full at this point.
Jeremy, they're probably going nuts.
And Rick, what about in Cleveland? I mean, they had a 3-1 lead in this series, and now it's tied up.
You know, Jeremy, this is Cleveland. In our sports history, people know. We don't lose like regular folks. It's got to be epic. It's got to be so gut-wrenching it gets its own name for posterity. That said, the mood of Cleveland's one of cautious optimism. I've heard opinions from fans that their faith is in pitcher Corey Kluber, that the Cubs maybe exhausted themselves fighting back from down 3-1. The Indians were embarrassed last night. They'll play with fire. So overall, it's surprisingly upbeat.
One of the storylines kind of heading into this World Series when it comes to Cleveland was this was the year that LeBron brought the Cavaliers to their championship, first time in a long time that Cleveland has had a sports championship, and now this could be the second time. Are people thinking about LeBron right now as they go head into this last game of the World Series?
It's kind of interesting the fact that twice the World Series game and a Cavaliers game have been playing side by side simultaneously. It's been 20 weeks since the Cavaliers won their title. The support they have shown their baseball brothers has been remarkable. Even last night, they hosted a watch party for 20,000 people at their arena, and the teams really have rallied. A lot of Cavaliers, after their game last night, went to a private box and sat at Progressive Field and watched the rest of the baseball game.
Well, Cheryl, I guess the underdog in this case would still be the Cubs, because it's very difficult, it's very unusual for a team to be down by so much and then come all the way back and win the World Series. What do the Cubs have to do tonight?
They have to play the way that they played last night. They have to play attacking the ball from the first inning on. But this is such an exciting time. Game 7, you can't ask for a better time of year matchup. It's going to be the greatest game I think we'll ever see.
Well, especially with this very divisive election, it's like the one nice thing that's going on at the same time is at least there's something else to watch.
The violence in Chicago. I mean, it's been so overwhelming what's going on in Chicago. This is just kind of a little respite away from it.
Rick, what are tickets going for right now for the game? And if you wanted one, could you still get one if you were willing to pay a lot of money?
If you're willing to pay a lot. We've seen numbers about $19,500 for one of the best seats. Average price last night after the game jumped to about $4,700. That said, if you walked by the downtown airport, not Cleveland Hopkins International, but the small airport, there were lots of planes coming in yesterday from Illinois. So a lot of people were buying those tickets and coming in. We've been surprised by how many Cubs fans have been here that have forked out the big money. We saw it with Toronto. It's just as bad with Chicago.
Besides the biggest celebrity, which of course is Scott Simon, who else has been able to, who are the celebrities we're going to see in the stands tonight? Cheryl, I'll go back to you.
Number one is Bill Murray.
Right.
And Bill Murray last night did a great thing. There was a Cub fan that drove in from Indianapolis, was trying to get a ticket, couldn't get a ticket, and he walked by her and he gave her a ticket, and it ended up sitting right next to him in the stands. How wild is that?
Wow. And Rick, what about a Cleveland celebrity besides LeBron, of course? Who else is?
Besides LeBron and the rest of the Cavaliers, Drew Carey gets a lot of play here. He's a native, and he was cited last night. But a lot of people were surprised at some of the folks that came in from around the country. I know Kurt Busch, the NASCAR driver, is a Chicago fan, but he was here.
And we know that John Hamm was at one of the games wearing a Cardinals hat.
Just, of course.
Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't you? So let's just fast forward to tomorrow. And let me ask you, Cheryl, first, if the Cubs win, what's going to happen in Chicago?
I think it'll be a party that'll last till next spring training. It will go on and on and on. I think they are waiting and willing and just wanting to explode. And that's what's going to happen.
And what if they lose?
A lot of people will be in depression and at their psychiatrist's couches.
And Rick, what about Cleveland? What if they win tonight? What's it going to be like tomorrow?
If they win, the party will start tonight and just continue on. I think we showed 20 weeks ago with the Cavaliers that we're kind of a polite city. We had 1.3 million turnout by some estimates for the Cavaliers parade and no trouble, one arrest. So I think we're expecting the same kind of thing when the Indians
and
win.
And if they lose?
Really, we hadn't thought about that.
That's
we have in Chicago.
Rick, they've got both teams have a lot of experience with that latter one. Let's see which one has to experience that again tonight. Rick Jackson with WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland and Cheryl Ray Stout of WBEZ in Chicago. May the best team win. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.